Interested in our next guest. Founded an organisation that in 2017 won a Nobel Prize for Peace. The area in which he's dedicated his life is, well, in many ways, focusing on nuclear weapons and nuclear disarmament. I asked you before, do you think there's more or fewer nuclear weapons in the world than there were back in 1986? Would you be surprised to know that the numbers have fallen by almost two-thirds? Interesting. I thought there's an argument that things might have gone the other way. There's an organisation called Peace Boat that are sailing around Australia at the moment, and some of the people on board are telling moving stories about their experience of nuclear weapons, and the broader mission is to advance the call for Japan and Australia to reject nuclear weapons and join the new UN treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons. The man behind all of that, in part, is Associate Professor Tilman Ruff from the Nossal Institute for Global Health at the University of Melbourne and founder of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, which has just won the Nobel Prize for Peace. Tilman, good morning to you. Thanks for coming in this morning.
Good morning, Leon. Thanks very much for having me.
Now, I thought the vessel was sort of open for tours this afternoon. Is it in port yet, and did you sail in on it?
No, I actually flew down, but it's coming to Hobart this morning. I didn't swing by the water this morning, so it might even be there yet, or pulling up as we speak, but it's just in town for today, and I'll be heading on it to Sydney. I'm very excited about that.
Who's on this ship?
It's about 1,000 people. People do tours, voyages with Peace Boat for several months at a time usually. It's almost a floating university. They go around the world doing all sorts of projects related to the cause of peace and justice, which is why Peace Boat was founded. This ship includes now a number of the survivors of the nuclear bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, a number of Indigenous Australian nuclear test survivors from the British tests that we had here in the 1950s. ICANN ambassador, former Senator Scott Ludlam, and a range of other people.
And is it like one of these sort of living library stories? Can people who head down to the dock this afternoon at 3 actually meet some of these people and talk to them?
There's an event on the Parliament House lawn at 12:30 to 2 where many of these people will be speaking. So everybody's welcome to that. Getting on the ship is a bit more difficult because of security arrangements. You have to have been registered with ID a couple of days ahead of time. But people can certainly see the ship and join that event, which should be very moving, I think, in Parliament House lawn.
The organisation that you founded won a Nobel Prize for Peace last year. Tell us about what that experience has been like. Have you received the prize yet?
Yes, the prize was announced in early October and then awarded on the 10th of December in Oslo. It's the only one of the Nobel Prizes that's decided and awarded in Oslo. It's a pretty big deal. And it's a particularly big deal, I guess, for us because it's the first awarding of a Nobel Peace Prize to an organisation or anyone that comes from Australia. It's an extraordinary event. It runs over several days. It virtually takes over Oslo. You're really in the global limelight in a way that I've never been before, and it's a very humbling and moving experience. The prize was accepted by one of the Hiroshima survivors, Setsuko Thurlow, who's done a lot of work with us, as well as our executive director, Beatrice Finn. So really moving, royal family, all of the Norwegian government, essentially the whole diplomatic corps in Oslo, basically there, most of them in tears.
And your very best suit and haircut and so on.
And my very best and borrowed stuff, I have to say. I don't have a penguin suit, so I borrowed one from a Norwegian friend, I have to say, for the banquet, where they have special cutlery and crockery that they actually just roll out on that one day of the year.
Wow, it's that special. Don't break it. The Martine text is a text. Thanks, Martine. The Peace Boat has docked. Thank you for that, Martine, this morning on Shipwatch. Associate Professor Tilman Ruff is our guest this morning from the Nossal Institute for Global Health at the University of Melbourne and founder of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, which, as we're discussing, has received the Nobel Prize for Peace. Introduce us to this ICANN group that you're part of.
Well, ICANN is really a global civil society campaign coalition. So it's not trying to set up a new organisation. It's trying to provide a way that lots of different civil society partners, so lots of different organisations, churches, trade unions, peace groups, environment organisations, all sorts of organisations, can work together, sing off the same hymn sheet, in a coordinated way to work for the goal of getting rid of nuclear weapons, the same way that we're getting rid of all of the other indiscriminate and inhumane weapons, biological and chemical weapons, landmines, cluster munitions. What's worked for all of them is agree that these are unacceptable weapons, nobody should have them, develop a treaty that actually formally bans them, makes them illegal under international law, and then work to progressively eliminate those weapons. And that's working for all of those others that I mentioned. It's been this extraordinary anomaly that the worst of all weapons, the most destructive, the last weapon of mass destruction not to be prohibited under international treaty, is the only one that can threaten all of our existence, nuclear weapons. So as when this UN treaty was adopted mid last year, this really is the first time that nuclear weapons have been made illegal under international law. So
but, that's I mean, these are all great intentions, but unless China, Russia and the United States particularly, and then these smaller actors like Iran and North Korea want to join you in this journey, it would seem that, you know, you drop yours first. Sure. Is going to paralyze, you know, any
absolutely
efforts and, to really get rid of them.
Yeah, and in part this has happened because of the increasing fear and concern that the risk of nuclear war is growing. There are no talks about talks. There are no disarmament is stuck. All of the states that have the weapons are investing more than $100 billion US dollars a year in maintaining, modernizing them, apparently planning to keep them indefinitely. They're not fulfilling their legally binding obligation to disarm.
So why don't you aim for something more realistic, like a greater control of nuclear weapons rather than their abolition altogether, something that seems like a, you know, with all due respect, like a pipe dream?
Well, everybody agrees that you're going to have to ban the weapons at some point. The disagreement is really about when. And essentially what we're doing is applying the lesson that's worked for all of those other weapons that I mentioned. I mean, even the states, Russia, US, China, the biggest states that opposed and weren't part of the negotiations for the cluster munitions and landmines bans, now boast that they're in virtually compliance with them in the case of the US. They have been profoundly influenced by them, even if they haven't signed up. They don't export landmines anymore. Their manufacture and use has declined dramatically. Treaties, once they're established, once they have strong global support, and this treaty was voted for by two-thirds of all the world's governments. This is, you know, not sort of some fringe thing. This is not just an idea. This is now a treaty that's going to enter international law quite soon. That really puts the pressure on. The fundamental thing that guided ICAN's strategy was, you know, where's the biggest difference that we can make? At the moment, the states that have the weapons are not serious about their commitment to disarm. They've opposed this treaty bitterly all the way, and I think their inconsistency, their lack of actually support for disarmament is now on plain view. What's the best thing that the rest of the world can do that doesn't have the weapons? They can't obviously get rid of weapons.
A really good point. What can Australia do?
So the best thing that they can do is ban the weapons, fill this gap that existed in international law that said that nuclear weapons were not illegal, the worst of all weapons. Yet, you know, you can't have, nobody claims that you can have sarin, nerve gas or smallpox, you know, as an essential national deterrent or you need it just in case in the back room. We should apply the same standard to weapons that are even worse. And that's not what this treaty is attempting to do. And the nuclear armed states are really on the back foot about this. They don't like it. This is not another piece of UN verbiage that they can happily ignore, as many fine words come from the United Nations. This is something that they're really deeply challenged by, their continued possession of nuclear weapons.
What does your position on nuclear weapons mean for your view, say, on nuclear power or nuclear medicine?
Well, those are rather different questions, particularly in the case of nuclear medicine, because we can actually make all of the isotopes that we need for diagnostic and therapeutic purposes in medicine without in any way being connected with nuclear weapons and increasingly without even needing nuclear reactors. And the ones that are currently used are very, very small. In terms of nuclear power, the big problem with nuclear power is that it inevitably creates the material that can make nuclear weapons. And so it's going to be an awful lot harder to get rid of nuclear weapons and keep them gone while you have these essentially potential bomb factories all over the world.
How do you feel about the fact that Australia is selling uranium to India, a non-signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty? I mean, what does that do for our standing when it comes to lecturing anybody on
uranium? I think Australia's credibility on disarmament is really worn thin to the point of being pretty bare at the moment. Initially, we had a bipartisan position that we should not be selling uranium to states that haven't embraced the NPT. That's now been broken. We sell uranium to most of the states that have nuclear weapons, in fact, under safeguards that we know are very limited and hardly apply in those countries. So there's no real reassurance that our uranium won't be used for weapons at some point now or in the future. We've got the experience of having nuclear tests in Australia and the devastation that caused. We claim we're on the right side of history for disarmament, but yet at the same time we say we need United States nuclear weapons to keep us secure and prosperous. So it completely undermines our credibility. If we need nuclear weapons, why should North Korea not also claim, or Iran or any other country not claim, that it needs nuclear weapons? It really is an inconsistency that we have to reconcile. We've signed every other treaty that bans an indiscriminate, inhumane weapon. We should do the same for the worst of all weapons.
You're on ABC Radio around Tasmania. Associate Professor Tilman Ruff is our guest this morning, and we're talking about abolishing nuclear weapons. It's a campaign that he's been part of, and indeed an organisation that's won a Nobel Prize for its work in this area. What happened to, remember 20, 30 years ago, there was huge debate about this in Australia. You'd drive through council areas and it'd say, you know, Glenorchy is a nuclear-free council area. There'd be big debates about what military vessels could moor in your harbours because of the possibility that they were fuelled by nuclear power. I mean, there was all sorts of debates like this going on. That seems to have faded away. Why?
It has, and I think it, in many ways it's because when the Cold War ended, there was, you know, nuclear weapons are big and horrible, nasty things to think about. And when the Cold War ended, I think there was a great sense of relief that maybe we don't have to worry about this god-awful threat every day of our lives anymore. And as you mentioned, nuclear weapons numbers have actually reduced from 70,000 to just under 15,000 now.
Oh, it's under 15,000.
So we can actually do this. I mean, if we kept dismantling nuclear weapons at the rate that they were dismantled, being dismantled at the fastest time, they'd be gone in 10 years or less. We can do this. But the problem, I think, is that it slipped off the radar, that we thought this problem went away, but it didn't. All of that architecture, all of those Cold War arsenals, all of those policies to have weapons on high alert, launch them very early, have not only continued, but investments in the nuclear weapons have continued. And the doomsday clock last week was moved forward to 2 minutes to midnight, as close as it's ever been. On the basis of concern about the increasing danger of nuclear war. Disarmament is going nowhere. And we've had a level of explicit nuclear threat, not just on the part of President Trump and Kim Jong-un in North Korea, but of Theresa May from the UK, President Putin in Russia, leaders of India and Pakistan. We're seeing investments and deployments, much more aggressive deployments of nuclear weapons exercises, you know, right up to borders than we've seen since the end of the Cold War. So we're really in a bit of a race of our lives. And frankly, you know, there's only two possible solutions here. It's either the end of nuclear weapons or the end of us as we sort of slide or slip inadvertently. You cannot retain these things.
This week's Economist had a really interesting dichotomy in there, that with hacking being the way that it is now and lots of stuff that we're told can never be hacked, that countries in the future might face the prospect of using their nuclear weapons or losing control of them in their silos, which is a very interesting thing to think about if a conflict of one kind or another begins.